Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to be talking about my favorite open source database, PostgreSQL. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb. Episode 549, recorded October 2nd, 2019, PostgreSQL. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, the original podcast from Red Hat. It's back for its third season, and this time it's all about the epic history of programming languages. Episode 8 is all about C, the language that made so many others possible. Go to redhat.com/heroes or listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And by Melissa. Bad data happens to good companies. That's why 10,000 businesses count on Melissa for clean, reliable address data. Get started today with 25,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEdge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it. This might be one of those today. Projects you might want to play with right after the show. This also might be one of those today. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Aaron Newcomb. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Randall. Good to be here.
It's been quite a while. It's been at least a few weeks, I think, right?
At least a few weeks. Yeah. Yeah. I try to get on as often as I can, but work keeps me pretty busy. So
that's the problem with those of us with actual schedules. You know, I have schedules, but I just say, and come on this show anyway. So I just tell my clients, it's, hey, I'm busy. I'm not available on Wednesday mornings. It's just the way it works. So I am speaking to you from, once again, from my home in Beaverton, Oregon. And I just noticed that door is open. I might have to close that door. It's sort of distracting. But now that I've mentioned it, it's probably even more distracting. I probably should shut up. I'll be here until very early tomorrow morning when I'm flying out for a 2-week trip. And Aaron, it looks like you're in your wife's makerspace again.
Yeah, that's my wife's makerspace behind me, which AKA English teacher's area. And then my makerspace is in front of me, which you can't see. I don't know. Do I have anything interesting to pull up today? Sure. What's this? I can always reach over and find something. Okay. So what we have here is a I don't even remember what this is. It's a – oh, I know what it is. Okay. So what we have here is a drive emulator for an Atari 800 XL. So I don't know. Let's see. This part is the little SD card there. I've got a little Arduino here. I've got a little logic chip on the end here. And I can hook that up to an Atari 800 XL, and I can read in disk images as if it were a, let's see, what was Atari? The 1050 floppy drive, I think it is. But I also have a 1050 floppy drive, so I can, you know, I can do real or virtual.
Wow. Cool. Fun cool. Times. I wish all of my experimentation is on the order of, software. So I wouldn't be able to have a hardware lab because I travel so much that I'd be away from it, you know, most of the time. So it's kind of crazy. Unless I put it in Tijuana, I guess. I'm more in Tijuana than I am in Portland. So maybe I would.
Or find a makerspace or find several makerspaces, you know, in the places you normally go. And then you can just go in and use their equipment.
There you go. Okay, maybe that would work. Okay, well, this show is not about us or about locations or about makerspaces. This show is about open source software. Today, I'm actually happy to announce that we're doing Postgres. Postgres is a very mature, powerful, I'm going to say the number one open source database out there, a relational database. I've been using it for years, so I'm really familiar with it. I highly recommend everybody that's using MySQL or Maria or one of the clones in that direction, to take a serious look at least in your next green start to use Postgres rather than MySQL. It's a much more mature database and much more standards compliant than anything else out there. In fact, I've heard from the SQLite guy that whenever he's staring at the standards trying to figure out how to implement something in SQLite and he can't figure it out, he just opens up the Postgres documentation and he just copies it from there. So the Postgres documentation is the reference documentation for SQLite. Let's just put it that way. So joining me today is an old friend of mine. I don't know how old he is, but he's a longtime friend of mine, David Fetter. I don't know if he's still doing it. We'll have to get into what his current relationship is with the project. But for a while, he was doing the PostgreSQL news. So he was putting out the newsletter of what was going on and things like that. And I think he's still doing that. But, you know, that's why he's coming on the show, so we can answer that. David and I also worked for the same client for a number of years, and I'm still maintaining his code. So I'm maintaining a lot of David Fetter code in my occasional day job for Insight Cruises. So we both worked for Neil Bauman of Insight Cruises for many years. So I've had Postgres on the show twice before, and it looks like about equal intervals. So it's kind of nice. So August of 2012. In episode 224, I had Ed Boyajian. I hope that's close. I'm sure David will correct me. And then in 2007, I don't know how to speak anymore. My very first episode where I was the host, where I was managing the show. Well, I was actually just the co-host at that point. Leo was the host. It was Josh Berkus. And so that was a long time ago. I mean, that was episode 18. That's how long I've been doing the show since 2007, at least running the show since then. So it's nice that we get to come back because, you know, every time we have a repeat, I always like to make it worth it. And David's going to talk a lot about what's happened since 2012. And I'm sure there's been a lot of things in Postgres. But anyway, so we'll have him on in a minute. Do you have anything else you want to say before I read the ad?
No, that's a pretty good intro, actually. I am also a longtime user of Postgres, not the experience level that you have. But I remember that show with Josh, actually, because I was at Sun at the time, and I believe he was as well. And Postgres was the database of choice, kind of, at Sun Microsystems until, of course, they bought the other one. MySQL.
Oracle?
So they bought MySQL, and then all of a sudden, you know, all the focus shifted there. And then, of course, Oracle came along, and it was all over. But I love Postgres, and I always recommend it for someone that really wants high performance. I don't know if that's still true, and I'm also curious to find out, you know, in this age of cloud database, right? In fact, I just had an invitation this morning from Red Hat to join some sort of a thing about a cloud. You know, run your databases in the cloud. It's all great. So I'm kind of curious too, like what the impact has been from the move to all these cloud providers in the database world. And does Postgres still kind of play well there, or is it you know, being left out of the party, so to speak?
Yes, and I'm also curious about how the movement to NoSQL databases has affected the I don't know if you really measure market share for an open source database like Postgres, but I'm curious about that as well. So, and it sounds like my throat is almost back to normal. I'm having an occasional scratch, but it's not bad. So consider it sort of DJ'd music where every once in a while we throw in a scratch. So, but let's get into the show. But before we do that, we have an important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, the original podcast from Red Hat. Time-sharing operating systems were the holy grail of the 1960s computing world. People dreamed of how time-sharing would open up the world of computing. While time-sharing turned out to be a dead end, that quest led to Unix and C, the programming language that made so many others possible. Command Line Heroes is back for its third season, and it's all about programming languages. From Perl to JavaScript to Ruby and C, the podcast dives into the origin stories of some of the most prominent languages around. Big dreams can lead to groundbreaking technologies, and sometimes small teams are the best at achieving those dreams. On their season finale, Episode 8, it recounts the history of C and how a team of four developers accomplished what huge teams couldn't. In the process, they paved the way for millions of others to enter the world of development and forge their own path. Command Line Heroes, an original podcast from Red Hat, is all about the people who transform tech from the command line up. To listen and subscribe, head over to the podcast platform of your choice or visit redhat.com/heroes. That's redhat.com/HEROES. There you'll find full episodes as well as bonus content. And you can even test your skills on the Command Line Bash arcade game. We thank Red Hat for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. By the way, I've been listening to this series, and it's been amazing. It's been wonderful. The episode that came out yesterday on the Unix and C gave me some backstory that I didn't have any access to. So I really appreciate that Red Hat has been producing this series. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest, David Fetter. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
Near San Francisco, Castro Valley, California.
Cool, you can see my home office. Okay, I'll wave in your general direction. It's sort of that way, sort of south of me. So there we go. Actually, it's a little bit inland from here, so it's more like south and slightly east. So that's over there. All right. That's enough of that. So give us the 30,000-foot view. When somebody is reaching for Postgres, what problem are they trying to solve?
Well, they have data they care about, and they want to be able to access it quickly and in some kind of organized fashion.
So what's Postgres's history? Why is it so cool?
Well, this goes back a very long way. First, there was Codd's paper that he wrote in 1969 and published in 1970. Shortly after that was a project called Ingress out of Berkeley that intended to make this paper into a software reality. A few years later, 1986, that's when I graduated from high school, they took some lessons learned from that project and called them the Post-Ingress project, and hence the name Postgres. We like to say that we've got the best database and the worst name in the business.
Yeah, especially because people have a hard time pronouncing it because they keep trying to figure out where that S goes, because they want to say SQL, which always hurts my ears whenever I hear somebody say SQL. That's not how it's pronounced. It's not how it's ever been pronounced. You know, there was a product out of IBM called SQL for a while, but it was spelled SQL, the whole word. But SQL is SQL, so it's PostgreSQL. But again, that S has got that sloppy location, so it's tough for people. How did you get involved with Postgres?
Believe it or not, well, I first started with the documentation. I found some that wasn't quite to my liking, and I sent in a patch. And wouldn't you know, they actually rolled it in there. That was around 2000. And I've been involved ever since. There's always something new and different to do there.
Are you still doing the newsletter?
Yeah, still doing that every week.
Okay.
People seem to like it, although mostly I find out by if I ever make a little tiny mistake of grammar or, you know, getting somebody's name wrong, I suddenly hear about it. Otherwise, I don't hear about it so much. That's about what I expect.
So let's just start with the elephant in the room, which is, I'm happy with MySQL. Why would I even look at Postgres?
MySQL has come a long way in the past few years. So that's actually a good thing. We were sort of, in a competitor-free zone for a while there, and that wasn't so great, at least on the technical side. Postgres is a very standards compliant database, and that means that you don't get wacky surprises apart from the ones that the standard provides. It's also very fast, and it works nowadays in for OLAP loads that MySQL just isn't yet suited for. So if you want to do sort of analytics, you can do that. If you want to do transaction processing, you can do that. It basically leaves an awful lot of green space out in front of you. It doesn't really constrict your choices.
Cool. And although I think in the opening of the show, I talked about it being a relational database, there are definitely some NoSQL features being added slowly, right? Like the JSON data types and more flexibility like
right.
that.
Right. So we added the JSON data types a few years back, and we've been, as we commonly do, we start with the sort of kernel of a feature, and then we kind of build on top of that over several releases until we get it to be something more mature. That's another way that Postgres tends to be a little bit different, is that we really stress getting the things that we roll out the door correct before we roll them out the door. And so that means that sometimes we pull back on a feature that that people had anticipated for a release because it's just not quite baked yet. That's kind of how we roll.
Yeah, I really noticed that. It's like I can always trust Postgres to do the right thing. It seems to be really good at that. Another feature of Postgres, and I'm probably going to try to enumerate most of the top-level features, so if I miss any, let me know. Another feature, at least one that I've used frequently, is the ability to embed other languages. So there's the classic PLP GSQL, which is like everybody else's stored procedures SQL. But there's also, you know, dozens, I think is probably a fair word, of other embeddable languages. And I know on the project you and I worked on together, we used Perl as an embedded language. And right. and it really made it easy to do to share some code. I was trying to get the same validation happening in the SQL layer that I had happening in the application, which is in Perl. And it was really nice to be able to just drop that down directly into embedded Perl. Is that something that a lot of people find useful?
The one that's most popular is the one of the more popular languages on Earth right now, which is JavaScript or ECMAScript or whatever you want to call it these days. So you can drop your code from your web application directly into a Postgres database and validate it exactly the same way. That's done with a thing called PLv8, V8 being the JavaScript engine from Google. You can also use Python and Ruby and basically you name it. And you can also write stuff in C where performance is extremely important. I hear you can do C++. I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah. And didn't you also write I think it was you that wrote the foreign adapter so you could have you look at somebody else's database, somebody else's table as if it was a table
right.
locally?
Sure. So I wrote the first draft of that in 2004.
Wow.
It was called DBI Link, named after Perl's very capable DBI layer, and they did most of the work. I just did a few attachments. Now, I did that in user space, and to my horror, there is still DBI Link code running in production on Wall Street. Don't do that these days. This was just a rough draft. It was just kind of the user space demo of what you're supposed to do. These days, foreign data wrappers are deeply integrated into Postgres, and you can now write them in various languages, including Python and Ruby. Unfortunately, there isn't a Perl one yet, but I guess that's a simple matter of programming. Foreign data wrappers, as you mentioned, will let you see things that are not Postgres as though they were inside Postgres, both reads and writes, if you choose to write that much of it. So there's a Twitter foreign data wrapper. There's a Git foreign data wrapper that I use every week for the newsletter. There's data wrappers for, you know, more ordinary things like MySQL and Oracle and MySQL. SQL Server and all the usual suspects, along with things like S3. And basically, if it can be presented as tabular data, you can probably expose it in Postgres and query it the same way. So you get a unified interface over all of those things.
So since Postgres has been around for a while, I'm kind of curious, and it sounds like you've been involved for quite a while. What is the most interesting thing that you've seen someone do with Postgres or a few of the things? I'm sure there's a ton of different ways that people have used Postgres in the past.
Sure. Well, somebody made a foreign data wrapper that would control Philips light bulbs. I thought that was pretty amazing. Just the idea of turning this into a machine controller, that has a lot of running room out in front of it. I'm interested that Postgres keeps spawning new proprietary forks and that those keep, you know, either doing some amazing thing or, contributing back work to the project. So currently there's some on each of the major cloud providers. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to name those here on the show, but you know, we all know who the big three of them are. And they've each got a cloud native, version of Postgres that they use. That's more or less, the community Postgres.
So are you saying like, I'll name some because I don't care, like Amazon RDS, is that what we're talking about here?
Or? Right. So they have RDS, they have Aurora, Aurora being one where they leverage more of their storage infrastructure for read scaling. Mm-hmm. And then Amazon has one and Microsoft has one, Google has one. It basically appears to be table stakes for cloud databases. People want to be able to click in Postgres, and this they've to varying degrees of quality. This is what they've done.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And I think I said in my intro, and I hope I'm still categorizing it this way because it's been. Trying to remember now, 14 years since I worked at Sun, something like that. No, it hasn't. It's been 9 years. What am I talking about? But anyway, when people used to ask me, because I used to deal with databases a lot because I'm an old storage guy. So databases, you know, I supported database teams. You know, we worked with customers. It was always a database problem. And I would always kind of describe Postgres as a higher performing database. So if you need something that's super high performant, there's certain things you can do with Postgres that you wouldn't be able to do. And like you said, there's been some development, I know, in MySQL land lately. But am I still describing that correctly? I mean, is that the way you would describe when to use Postgres, or is it? I know you can use it anytime, but I mean, what are the table stakes here?
Sure. So it's great when you need to be able to scale out or scale up and scale out these days. Mm. So you can choose which direction you want to go, whether it's buying more iron or buying more nodes. It's also really, really flexible, as we were sort of talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. It has places to plug in where other database management systems simply don't. So if you want to plug in your own language or your own indexing method or your own, you name it, basically Postgres will frequently have places where you can put a function pointer and go to town. That's called the hook system. So yes, there's amazing performance. one of the performance things that we've discovered lately is if people are familiar with sprintf from the C library, that was starting to get to be a bottleneck in some of our use cases, and so we've had to replace bits of it.
Wow.
So that's not the usual thing that slows people down, but in our case it did.
No, that's why I said, wow, I wouldn't have connected those two things in a million years. But I guess it makes sense in a way. Mm-hmm. You mentioned horizontal and vertical scaling as well. And I assume by horizontal, you mean the clustering capability of the database, correct?
Right. So there are several different clustering capabilities that are built in. One is the physical wall-based replication write-ahead log. And that is basically you take the pub node of the database and you make as many sub nodes as you like with a little bit of lag, or you can choose to tune it towards synchronous replication. But unless you're a bank, you probably don't want to do it that way, because you know CAP says that when you want the thing to be available all the time, you don't have it perfectly consistent. So people tend not to choose that version very often. Then there's various kinds of logical replication, where you can take slices out of the database and replicate those elsewhere. And those can sometimes go to nodes where you could both read and write. There has been a little bit of work on multi-master replication, but that is not in the that's not in the community Postgres. That's in some add-ons. So that's another way that you can do it. But generally, multi-master takes a bite out of things that you don't want bitten. So most people, when they first think they want multi-master, they have a look at what trade-offs are actually involved, and it's usually not the right thing for people.
Interesting to hear you say that, because I would think that if anytime I'm doing clustering with any technology, I'm probably looking for some sort of load balancing and also some sort of protection for my data. If one node goes down, I've got replicas somewhere else, that it's not a big deal, which those two things combined make it sound like something I could pick up potentially and shove into the cloud in a series of containers, for example. And then I would have this nice database cluster in the cloud where, if one went down or wasn't performing, I could just pull that container down and replace it with another one. Is that possible? Or it sounds like you're saying, maybe, but
okay, so
maybe don't do it.
When I say multi-master, I mean that two different nodes are taking writes at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The physical wall-based replication enables exactly the kind of scenario that you were just describing, where basically the write node goes down, or the write node is somehow not performing. You can quickly promote it to some other node to be the write node and rearrange your cluster, and you're good to go. So that part's handy. Where containers kind of fall down at the moment is that they, as far as I know, they don't access storage quite as quickly as they might. So they don't have pair virtualization the way some of the VMs do. And so when you're containerizing Postgres, you're kind of taking a hit on performance that you might not want to take. Maybe there's been recent changes in that, but that was the state of the art as of, you know, a year ago when I really dug into it.
Yeah.
You can
yeah.
still do it. But if you need to wring every little bit out of the hardware, the container is still going to take a chunk out of you.
Yeah. And very interesting. I, cause you know, storage was always the backbone, right, of the database. And so, you know, the more performance we could throw it at these big databases, Postgres is one, of course, Oracle's another, the faster we could get the storage going. I mean, that was always seemingly the bottleneck. And so it's interesting to hear about some of the, you know, when you start applying this to newer technologies like containers, you start introducing some of those things that we maybe solved for in the data center, you know, yeah. 10 years ago or so. So that's really sure. interesting.
Sure.
Go ahead.
One of the things we've noticed is that because of some of the newer technologies in storage, NVMe, for example, that's starting to expose bottlenecks in CPU. And that's where we, you know, that's one of the things that helped us find out that sprintf was actually being a problem for us. So that's a little counterintuitive, because normally when you think of databases, you think of them as being basically I/O bound all the time, and it turns out that for some workloads they're not; they're CPU bound. We've been working on that for a few years. There's now a just-in-time compilation infrastructure the Postgres has got that lets you compile queries down into more efficient forms when they're running for a long time.
Go ahead. I was just going to say Aaron wants to ask some more questions. I want to ask some more questions, but before we do that, I first want to berate Aaron for saying MySQL.
Sorry, old habits die hard.
I know.
My mistake. I did it too.
And we actually do have some questions in the chat room about exactly how to pronounce Postgres in all of its various forms. So I just say PG. It's much faster. But anyway, but before we do that, I do have an important message. Because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by the leader in address verification, Melissa. Every address is covered from Adelaide, Australia to Zipaqueta, Colombia, and everywhere in between. We all know there's nothing good about bad data. It costs money, hurts sales, and decreases customer satisfaction. If bad addresses, duplicate records, and bouncing emails are hurting your business, isn't it time to come clean with Melissa? Delta Faucet, Z1 Motorsports, and Car2Go use Melissa. You should too. Delta Faucet was able to improve their call center processes with global address auto-completion. Melissa was able to reduce the fraudulent e-commerce transactions for Z1 Motorsports by 90%. Melissa provides a full spectrum of data quality protection for your customer data. Verify postal addresses, mobile numbers, and email addresses. Update the addresses of customers that have moved and eliminate duplicate records. Gain additional customer insight into your data with Melissa's analytics. Easily build address verification and customer data verification into your customer application using Melissa's APIs, CRM cloud connectors, and e-commerce plugins, or upload your customer file for a quick data cleanse. Melissa is serious about securely managing your data. They continually undergo independent security audits to enforce their commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. SOC2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. Mailers spend about $20 billion annually in undeliverable mail. Don't lose customers or cash. Make every address count. Bad data happens to good companies. That's why 10,000 organizations worldwide trust Melissa to get their customer data clean and accurate. Get started today with 25,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/TWIT, or call 1-800-MELISSA to find out more. And we thank Melissa for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go back to that pronunciation question. So how, I mean, it's an awkwardly written word. So how do you pronounce it? What's the guide for that?
For me, the QL is silent, so I just say Postgres.
That's one way out. Yes.
Yep.
So I think officially it's PostgreSQL. Believe it or not, there when we were looking at ways to advertise the SQL layer, that was less bad than some of the options that we had on the table.
Right, because Postgres for a while existed without the SQL layer. It was some sort of other, was it like a COD language or something?
I mentioned Ingress before. That had a language called Quell, which lost to SQL because, well, they were going up against IBM, and IBM was the elephant in the room at the time.
Sure.
And then when they spawned off the Postgres project with separate code, they had a language called PostQuell. And then in 1994 or so, a couple of grad students at Berkeley decided to replace PostQuell with the SQL, and they released that. And for a while, it was called Postgres 95, which didn't seem like it would age well.
No,
we had to come up with a new name for the project.
Yes. It's like Windows 98 hasn't really aged very well either. So,
no.
So what's happened in the last few years? I know we added CTEs and a few other things. What's been the major changes over the last few years?
Gosh, that's a big one. So, Common Table Expressions made SQL Turing complete, which is good and scary if you're trying to lock the thing down.
Right.
We added basically clustering capabilities of various different kinds. So physical replication, logical replication. We added, I should say smart people who are not me, are making more of the executor parallelizable so that more than one core can work on a query. This turns out to be super important in the OLAP or analytics or whatever they're calling it this week. Basically queries that take over a second in round trip is how I think about it. Another exciting thing that's been happening over a couple of releases is the idea of adding new storage engines. Yes, my SQL got it a little bit earlier, but we like to think we have these things fully baked before they're ready. One called ZStore that may be in 13, and that's a column-oriented storage engine. You do those for aggregates, and that's a major part of the OLAP workload. Let's see, in CTEs in the upcoming 12, which I believe is still coming out tomorrow. There used to be an optimization barrier where you'd put a with clause and it would execute to the end no matter what happened to afterwards. We kind of removed that barrier. And you can still have it if you're really counting on it, but you have to say so. So basically, if you do a with and it doesn't have a recursive and it isn't referred to more than once, quals get pushed into it instead of having the thing execute to the end and materialize in memory and all that kind of unfun stuff that could happen if it produced a lot of rows.
So it doesn't have to materialize the entire subtable anymore.
That's right.
Wow. I was just thinking that was one of the things that actually makes CTEs a little annoying now, is that I have to think about the fact that it's materializing the entire subtable. So it's not just the same as taking, like if I have a complex expression, I just want to make it easier to read by moving into a CTE. I'm also automatically removing any search or a query optimization. But you're saying now that it's coming out. Oh, wow, that's going to be cool.
Yeah, so that's tomorrow's release, unless something has gone drastically wrong. Let's see, what else? We've consistently gotten about a 10% overall performance increase with every release. So since the last time, according to my calculations, it's about twice as fast. as it had been before. Yeah, we're starting to see bottlenecks in places that you just wouldn't expect, and that's okay. We have people that write C very, very well, and we've brought in part of the infrastructure from LLVM in order to help address some of those concerns. And that's the just-in-time compilation, which is kind of a bit of a misnomer. It's basically adding in compilation steps at various parts of the process, not just right at the end.
Okay.
So that's helped speed things up in a gigantic way.
We have a couple questions from the chat room, so let's take those first, then we can keep going through your list here. So Rourke's frequent member of our chat room says, what version of the SQL standard are they in compliance with nowadays?
Nobody is in full compliance with any version of the SQL standard, but we're shooting for that's unfortunately the case. They go and write this standard without writing a reference implementation, and that frequently falls on us. So we're shooting for SQL 2016. We've got a large fraction of it, and we have some people on the SQL Standards Committee, and we hope to have a little bit more influence on what happens to it in the future.
Cool. And Gray580, also a frequent member of our chat room, says, does Postgres support database mirroring?
Which I
know the answer to yes.
Yeah. Yes, it's you can choose replication of various different kinds. And one of them is there are several variations of synchronous replication. I think that's, if I understood the question right, I think that's the answer.
I think that's pretty close. Yeah, we'll let that be the answer. That's fine. Okay. And I got to scroll back again because we got to get the right person for this first. Reverb Mike asks, when will it support blockchain?
When will it support blockchain? Well, that's already been done. I knew there would be a question on this at PGCon in, I believe it was 2016 or 2017. Somebody added on an extension that does blockchain. So yes, we're blockchain compliant.
Nice, wonderful. And when you were talking about various storage engines for MySQL, I don't know if it was just a joke or whether it was actually practical. I remember somebody actually used an embedded Postgres as the storage engine for MySQL for an instance of it. So I thought that was sort of cute. Pretty clever. Yeah. Aaron, you got a few more questions?
Well, I wanted to get back to the performance questions I had earlier. One of them that you hear about a lot, trying to make databases faster, is running in memory. And I don't remember if Postgres supports some sort of in-memory option. Does it?
Not really. What happens is that it currently uses the operating system's cache to run a lot of things. But in the end, when you do a write, it has to be durable, and so that has to go all the way out to storage. And we're working on ways to make that more efficient. But right now, it goes through the kernel and fsync and all that kind of fun stuff. We discovered some corner cases where fsync wasn't actually doing the thing that it promised to do in one of the popular Unix-like operating systems. And then it turned out that in some of the Unix operating systems, it wasn't doing it right either. So we've had some fraught conversations with the kernel developers of those outfits, and I think some good has come out of it.
Okay, cool. So we'll see on that one. I mean, I get why people want to do it. I think that the the way that application development and the way that applications are written is changing in such a way that, you know, except for those, those large legacy apps, they'll be around for a while. But I think most of the development for newer applications is running more towards, deploying in the cloud and kind of architecting your application a little differently. So you don't need that. But we'll see what happens on that. I think the jury's still out on how long those legacy apps will be around. The other question I wanted to ask is, as you guys were talking, it occurred to me that, you know, Postgres is one of those things that's been around for so long that you must have a lot of backers, supporters, companies that are chipping in. I mean, you just must be overrun with cash at this point to be able to go hire developers and all that. Is that true? Is there certain company bases that you rely on for funding?
Right. So we have some that are long-term, like Enterprise DB, whom you guys talked with last time. Mm-hmm. And then we have people coming in and out and over shorter periods of time, like, you mentioned your former employer, some microsystems. Mm-hmm. And so we have a pretty stable base of support, although it's sort of a dynamic stability. So we'll have somebody come in and then we'll have somebody else leave. So it's not always the same companies, but there's always, if you're a Postgres committer, you will never lack for employment. Of course, that's like about 100 people in the world these days, but there's always somebody that will hire you to work on Postgres itself, in addition to their, you know, whatever their proprietary thing is.
Well, David, we're almost out of time, and so I need to start wrapping up, but I do want to not let the moment go by that I don't actually thank you for having chosen Postgres for Captain Neal's database, because had you chosen MySQL, I would have a reason to hate you. It would be really, really ugly every time I had to work with that. So thank God for you having chosen Postgres for the database I get to continue to maintain. A few of the things you did with it, I'm a little confused, but that's probably I think.
Well,
I'll just
I was learning the
there.
Trade at the time.
Yes,
I would do it differently if I did it now.
Yes. The whole place where we have a left-handed, right-handed steering wheel, where this one value is expressed in two columns that have to be mutually not incompatible. You know the one I'm talking about.
That was a bad mistake, and I'm sorry.
Because it still ends up messing up my code occasionally when we're trying to work it out. The add-on table, I think it is. Whatever that is. Anyway, enough of that. We asked a lot of questions. We could have talked another hour easily, I'm pretty sure. But is there anything we didn't ask that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
Well, there was one thing which was the best innovation in Postgres in the past few years, by my lights anyway. We mm-hmm. went from a three-part version number to a two-part version number. And so now there's not any confusion about 10 versus 11 versus 12. If you were working with the 9.0 series or the 9 series, you were referring to 6 different databases that were all, you know, of extremely different quality. And so we when we moved to a less confusing versioning system, I think that was one of the big ones.
Nice. Okay, anything else?
No, that's we didn't talk too much about the giant JSON capabilities, but there's a SQL standard for those, and we're bringing that in. Looks like we're also bringing in capabilities to do graph searches. So those specialty graph engines, those might be kind of rolling in, and so that you don't have to, you know, you don't have to pay for a network hit to talk to your graph engine anymore. That's probably Postgres 14 territory, but that's coming up.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I have to ask you the two required questions or my audience gets mad at me. What's your favorite text editor?
Well, I still use Vim. I'm learning more about it every day. Sorry.
That's okay. People can use Vim. Somebody has to use Vim. So I'll just keep using Emacs and run circles around it. And your favorite scripting language. And this one I may actually know. Maybe not.
Well,
maybe
that it's least favorite now. No, I used to use a lot of Perl, but to be honest, I use a lot of JQ and SQL now to do scripting things in. I know that second one sounds a little odd, but it's it turns out that you can do a lot with it.
Cool, cool. Well, David, it's been good seeing you again. I haven't seen you in years. It's just been a matter of timing.
I think we were at Neil's a couple years back.
Yeah, like for Thanksgiving or something, wasn't it? Wasn't there like a maybe not.
I think Scale.
Okay, yes. All right. Oh, and Scale, yeah, obviously. Right. all right. Well, good to see you again. And thanks for coming on and talking, bringing us up to date on Postgres. And I wish you luck with everything you're doing.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Cool. That was David Fitter talking to us about Postgres, one of the subjects I actually know some of the most about of all the shows I do here. So I was glad to chime in. Aaron, you had a question about CTE and you looked it up and it's a common table expression. It's a cool way of sort of factoring out a chunk of your code as if it's a table of its own. So you can then join from there and so on. It's actually pretty cool. Got added a couple years ago, maybe a few years ago. Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, you guys were kind of geeking out there, and I was like, wait a second, I don't know what a CTE is. I got to look that up. You guys kind of went deep there for a second, and I was like, I don't know what this stuff means. I don't work with it enough on a daily basis anymore. But no, it's really good to hear. I think there's a couple things that I was thinking about as you guys are talking about. It's good to hear that the project is obviously still very popular, successful, running well, getting support. Being picked up and used in different ways. That's always kind of an odd feeling, I think, if you're a project owner or somebody that works on a project and someone forks it, it's like, why can't they just, contribute back to my thing? But I'm glad they forked it at the same time, because that means that they're interested enough to take it and do something else. And that's the power of open source. So that was kind of interesting. And then the other thing that was interesting to me was just how much it's one of those projects that's been around for a while. You can really see the power of open source. Yeah. So, for example, they were talking about the problem they were having with SprintF, that's such an old C thing that's been around for forever. And yet, it kind of comes back and the ways that people are contributing to the project and using the project, I think, it really speaks volumes, to the power of what you can do with open source software to really have a big impact. It's unfortunate, I think, that, well, I don't know if it's unfortunate, but the example that he gave early on about this financial institution that was still running, some ancient stuff, sometimes that's unfortunate, but at the same time, it's open and available. So if that company, for example, was using some sort of proprietary package to do that functionality, right, they wouldn't be able to support it. Now, it's unfortunate they have to support something so old, but they can support it because it's open source. So all those things were kind of ruminating in my head, and I'm just glad we could have him back on for an update.
Yeah, it's very cool, and he's very knowledgeable about it, obviously. So it was a good conversation. I think I picked up a couple things in the middle of the show, too. So it's not like my knowledge of Postgres is infinite like his is, apparently. So it's good. excuse me. What most people don't know is that Perl's SprintF, that's at the core of SprintF and PrintF, was actually written for Perl, I think it was 4.036. And the problem was that the SprintFs that were provided by the libcs and the various distributions differed enough that it impacted the Perl code. And also it had potential buffer overflow problems. And so I believe it was Chip Salzenberg who wrote a totally new implementation of SprintF. So the code that's been shipping for almost 20 years with Perl for SprintF is actually its own SprintF from way back in the day. So that's pretty cool. These little things I know, having been around for a while. So anyway, I enjoy Postgres. I enjoy common table expressions. It's really an easy way. You should see this one query I have for Cap'n Neil. I basically have about 15 tables that are built up on previous tables. Mm-hmm. And I had originally been trying to do this based on one giant, truth clause. And it was getting harder and harder because you had to keep naming the sub expressions and then joining those the right way. And it was just a mess. Whereas bringing out a CTEs made it really obvious what I was doing, essentially set up a little assembly line, build this, which is all the current and future cruises, build this, which is all the bookings on those cruises, build this, which is all the people in all those bookings. And it became very clear what was going on. And I really appreciate that. It's not that I couldn't do it the other way, but really nice with CTE. So definitely, if you haven't cool. if you haven't seen that in Postgres, go take a look at it. And it's standards compliant. That's actually something that came out of the standards body, and so they implemented it precisely the way the standards guys wanted to. So, and in general, although David said that nobody's perfectly standards compliant. If you look at the half a page or less of where Postgres doesn't comply with the standard, you see their reasons for why they deviated for every one of them. And it's just because the standard is messed up. It's just so they're basically overvoting the overriding the standards body. So let's talk about who's coming up, because we actually got a couple new guests added onto the list, and we're almost out of time. So let's do that. Next week is David Wheeler, who is on a five-peat. He says this will be his fifth time on the show. He's going to be talking about the changes that have been happening in the best practices badge, which he was on episode 389, which is not that long ago, but he was on that show talking about best practices. I registered for it, but I never actually put it on my website. So I get an email every couple months saying, how come it's not on the website yet? So I have to go do that. Chameleo, it's an open source SIP server released under GPL, able to handle thousands of call setups per second. So it's probably in the the region of like a competitor to Asterisk or something. I don't know. We'll have to ask them when they come on. Just added to the show. Is Singularity, which provides a single universal on-ramp from developers' workstations to local resources to clouds and all the way to the edge. So it's great for basically building containers that are going to deploy and test and all that sort of stuff. That's actually a problem we're trying to solve at work right now. So one of my work anyway. Hacker Public Radio, which is a similar podcast about open source hardware and software. I've never listened to it, but I'm apparently going to be on it sometime soon. We haven't worked that out yet. But we're going to have a couple of the people who are hosts of the shows. It's multiple shows. There's a show 5 days a week, so it's a lot more work than I'm willing to put in. And then just added to the list, Kong was on about a year ago. It's a next-generation API platform for multi-cloud and hybrid organizations. They've made a number of changes. Kong 2.0 just came out, I think. So they want to come on and talk about the changes that have been made to that. It's an open source way of doing APIs, I guess. So that's pretty cool. That's all I have on the list right now. We are adding two every week, which means I'm slowly getting ahead and have more in the list than I had like 3 or 4 weeks ago. But that doesn't mean I couldn't use your suggestions. Please, if you have a project that wants to be on the show, please have the community coordinator or project leader email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My email address is on the homepage for this show, twit.tv/floss. We do a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions from there. I've been whispered in my ear. I should also talk about the new bulletin board system that we have. That dates me.
Bulletin board system. Join our PBS. Fire up that Commodore 64.
Get out your Penny Whistle 103 modem and connect to twit.community. That's the actual URL, twit.community. And I'll be there, and some of the other hosts will be there, and we'll be talking with you and chatting with you. That's kind of replacing. So I'm Randall Schwartz there, and Aaron apparently is Aaron Newcomb there. We'll be checking in hopefully daily. Hopefully there's an RSS feed so I can just drop it into my RSS reader. But yeah, it's a forum. But yeah, I said BBS. I'm getting old. I'm getting old.
I've got a project for that.
Yeah.
Talk about that another time. Maybe next time I'm on, I'll show people that project.
All right, great. And you can follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter, and me and at Merlin on Twitter. I'm going to also see if I can get the forum, maybe the announcements there, to also tweet over automatically. I'll have to figure out how to connect all that together. I'm going to be at All Things Open in just a mere week and a half away. That's in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm presuming there's still something left of that after all the storms they've had there. You can still register for it at the discounted rate, the lowest discounted rate, by typing Floss Weekly in all lowercase, one word, in their registration box. So we'd love to see you there. If you're there and you see me, please come up and say hi. I'm a fan of the show or whatever, or I hate the show. Let me know either way. I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have many haters coming up to me, but you never know. You never know. Aaron, anything you want to plug?
I am going to be doing some traveling, and so I'm going to call out a few of those. So next week I'll be in Melbourne, Australia, for an event that we're doing at my work, AppDynamics. And I've got a couple extra days. So I don't know if we have any Aussie viewers. I assume we do. If you're there, you want to get together for a cup of coffee. I hear there's great coffee in Melbourne. I've never been there. I'm looking for some things to do. So if you want to meet up while I'm there, you know, let me know. I'll be there most of the week. Well, Wednesday through Saturday mostly. And then after that, there's a couple of big cloud conferences coming up. So I will be at Microsoft Ignite. I almost called it Reignite. Microsoft Ignite in Orlando. And I'll also be at, and this is why I almost called it that, AWS reInvent in Vegas. Also, you know, for AppDynamics, but you know, there's always free time to meet up, say hi, sign a copy of my book, Linux for Makers, which you can go buy now and then bring for me to sign. But that's what I'm up to. So if you're in any of those areas or at those events and you want to say hi, I'd love to talk to you and just see, you know, meet some viewers. That'd be great.
I've been to Melbourne a few times. And one time I was coming home from the conference, which was sort of southeast of the city, and I was coming on the train. And my hotel was downtown, so I was supposed to travel about six stops and then get off the train and then go to my hotel. Well, no, I fell asleep on the train. And the train goes about, 30 kilometers southwest and ends. And I was on the last train.
Oh, man.
So, and that's, you know. I'm in the middle of nowhere, right? And my cell phone didn't work there at the time. Now it would work, so that would be fine. But it didn't work at the time. And there was one light on a pub that was just across the street. And I went into there, and they said, "We're closing." And I said, "Yeah, but I fell asleep on the train. I need to get back downtown." And not only that, I have a 9 a.m. presentation at the conference. So I need to get home soon. It was like 11 at night, maybe 11:30 at night. And so they called a cab for me, and it was something like all the spare cash I had on me to get back to downtown. And I slept maybe 3 hours and then went to my presentation. You know, the show must go on. But that's one of my most recent memories of Melbourne. The other one is, and I'd recommend this strongly, if you can find somebody to take you out, I think it's called Healed Park. It's like a wildlife refuge. It's about 20 minutes northeast of town. And but it's if you look for, just look for animal park, because they have koalas and they have all sorts of unusual things. They have a room that has like 8 of the 10 deadliest snakes. Luckily it's behind a barrier, so you can't get hurt. But it's like It's a really interesting experience. I've been there twice now, three years apart. It was worth going back to. Let me just say that.
Yeah, I'll check it out for sure. That's a great recommendation. Yeah,
I think it's Heald Park, H-E-A-L-D. That sounds right. But you can Google for Animal Park Melbourne and you'll probably find it easily. Anyway, enough on that, and we're over time, so I want to get out of here. So thank you, Aaron, once again for showing up on your occasional experiences here. I know you're a very busy person, so thank you for stepping into this one.
Yeah, no worries. I'm gonna go get my Commodore 64 out so I can dial into the Twit community.
And we'll see you all again next week from FOSS Weekly.